Here's what's coming up on today's show.
It's about collecting the right players, putting them in the right position, and then executing on your plays, but making sure that your plays come back to the fundamentals of the game or the business.
As a real estate agent, you may find it difficult handling the financial side of your professional and personal life. We're here to help. This is Agent Money, how top producers master their business and personal finances with certified financial planner Jordan Kernut and fractional CFO Michael Kilner.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Agent Money Podcast. My name is Michael Kilner. As usual, I am joined by my co-host, Jordan Kernut. Jordan, good to see you.
Good to see you, Michael.
Good to see you. And today, we have an amazing guest. We have really started this podcast with some high-level players. And so that guest is Ty Voiles. Ty is the CEO, co-CEO of Fulcrum Properties Group in D.C., we've collaborated in the past. Ty has been an excellent advocate for me in my career, and he has a great story, and we're really excited to listen to it. So, Ty, welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Good to see you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been a while, and so I want to know how the last few years have treated you. But first, we gotta start at the beginning. This is where we started with everybody who's been a guest is. How did you get started in real estate?
Yeah, I kind of backed into it. So 21 years ago, I moved to Washington, D.C. to take a project management job as a government contractor. I worked in the aviation field with the DOD, and we built training systems around flight simulators and mechanics for planes and helicopters. And I did that for 5 years, and then I took a pivot and moved over to work at the Library of Congress in similar software development and project management oversight things, and lasted there about a year and a half, and just really wanted something that had more pace to the work. As you can imagine, working with government contractors and librarians, right? Like pace was not the big driver of the workplace. People were wonderful. But I at that point, moved into a job as a project manager doing environmental construction at a nonprofit that was really focused on stormwater management. And I took a 60% pay cut when I left the private industry and went to go work for a nonprofit. And I picked up my real estate license as kind of a way just to bridge the gap there. So I started off in real estate as a fancy name would be a dual career agent, which really means a part-time agent. So I started off that part-time, I sold a couple of houses in the first year, started just kind of building a pipeline of people, and looked up in December of 2010 and realized that my wife and I were married and we had our first kid, and I had two jobs and not enough time to spread across everything that I wanted to do. So I looked at what the career paths were, and I knew that I wanted to own a business. I knew that I wasn't really wired to work for anyone but myself. And it seemed to me that real estate was the fastest, straightest line to get there. And that, building my own green roofing company was probably going to be a little bit more arduous. So I picked real estate and I dove in full time in 2011. I was an individual agent. I worked under a guy named Jim Lasowski, who was my mentor coming in for real estate. And Jimmy and I shared an office and shared some expenses, and he taught me the ropes. And about 6 months later, we brought in a third person to kind of round that out. And that guy is Tom Cavanaugh. And Tom is still my business partner today. So in 2012, Jimmy and Tom and I had been sharing an office and an assistant, some shared expenses, but we had a really kind of eat what you kill mentality. So we all had our own clients, we closed our own transactions. We didn't do any sort of, income or revenue share. We were three individual agents, sharing resources, which it's funny today, to this day, is still what a lot of teams are, what a lot of small teams are. And we got introduced to a couple of people at Keller Williams in the Washington, D.C. office. Brandon Green was the first of those who really kind of introduced me to Gary Keller's Millionaire Real Estate Agent, lovingly referred to as the Red Book, which showed us a path to build a true business in real estate. So that was where things kind of got started. At that point, we really made a financial change. Jimmy, Tom, and I committed to each other as true business partners. We realized we each had different skill sets, but a really similar value system and value proposition at the base of our business. And we wanted the same things. You know, we wanted flexibility. We wanted reliability from one another. We wanted scalability for something that we could grow beyond just the three of us. But we also wanted some structure and some predictability, which in real estate is really hard to get. You know, a lot of agents' years or careers go through these peaks and valleys and ebbs and flows. And we realized, I think we can turn this into a partnership that really prevents that and gives us steady income, but also gives us the ability to store cash for rainy days and to distribute on a regular basis. And so, you know, we formed an LLC. We put ourselves, the three of us, on salary, and we just started cranking out and trying to put as much money in the bank as we could as we laid a baseline for our business. So when we moved to Keller in 2012, we formed that and we officially formed Fulcrum Properties Group. So that was kind of the launch point. And from there, you know, we all dove into the Red Book. We got really familiar with the models and the systems. We picked our individual roles that we would play. And then contrary to advice, you know, we got really creative before we implemented the models. So one of the first things that, you know, we built off of and ended up being a mistake was, you know, we said, look, real estate agents, you know, for the most part, have the same experience that we have, and they want some consistency. So, you know, we broke with the tradition of having standard splits for agents based on being buyer's agents or listing agents. We put our agents on a salary, and it wasn't, you know, a full salary, but it was definitely a socks and underwear kind of salary is what we like to call it. You know, like you weren't going to pay for your haircuts, but, you know, you could contribute to groceries and a little bit of your rent or mortgage with that. But what it allowed them to do was hopefully take that edge off so nobody was walking around with commission breath, right? And then do some deals on a monthly basis that would give them bonuses. Now, the structure that we put behind that, we realized didn't incentivize them to really produce at the highest level. And I think it was counterintuitive to putting someone in a sales position, especially somebody with a sales mentality, into a sales position, right? So I don't remember exactly what the structure was. I'm trying to erase those memories from my brain, I guess, willingly ignore them. You know, but I think it was, right, if the math that we did was basically like, if you're closing two deals a month with us on a salary, it's basically the same as closing three deals a month on your own, you know, which is great. But what that does is it prevents your really high producers from pushing to want to close four or five deals a month. You know, it creates this incentive almost for sandbagging. And right, it took us a good year and a half, 2 years to realize that while it provided some stability and it allowed us to bring in agents that, you know, we felt fit our culture really well, that didn't lead with productivity, but were productive agents, it hamstrung us in our ability to really grow leaders, and it hamstrung us in the ability to judge quality really quickly. It also put a lot of pressure around us, because one of the benefits of growing a team once you have your operations in place is bringing agents in is not a costly thing to do from a check writing standpoint, right? It's a costly thing to do from investment of time, you know, dedication, but it didn't, you know, it generally shouldn't cost much to bring on an agent, bring them into your database, roll them into your business. But when you're shelling out a salary for somebody, you know, and they've got a 3 month runway or a 4 month runway that you've got to fill up, you know, it creates some issues around that. So that was one of the first money lessons that we learned was, you know, there's a model for building a team, and you should probably stick to it. Otherwise, you end up either hamstring yourself or paying some financial penalties for it.
What's interesting is that I totally recognize the pain point that you were trying to solve. So do you think there was something, is there anything that helped solve that pain point? Even if it's not that salary method, but is there something that you guys could iterate on that would have kind of solved for that, but also kept the edge so that people could actually do a lot of production?
Yeah, I mean, for the agents on our team, I don't know if there really is a financial structure that does that. You know, I think that if anything, you look at the real estate landscape, that's kind of the model that Redfin runs right now. You know, their agents get paid a salary, they get paid a bonus based on closings and customer satisfaction. So it has the ability to, for an agent to increase their income based on the amount of deals that they do. That said, it's also a completely dependent brokerage model, right? Like Redfin is giving their agents every single lead that they work. And when you are looking to build a business that's based on growth, not just from lead delivery to agents or appointment delivery to agents, which has incredible value, but also teaching them to connect with their people and work their spheres, I think it does really limit the ability to solve for that pain point. Now, for us as three co-owners of a business who knew that we had different levels of productions, but we also had equal contribution coming from different areas, and that the value, right, maybe not necessarily the revenue was equal, but the value that we brought, that we all agreed that we brought was equal, it did solve the problem, because what we did is we agreed on what our salary was going to be. We ensured that we had enough money in reserves to pay that salary for months on end, even if we didn't have a closing. And then we were able to say, okay, great. Well, one of the challenges that agents have is, how do I have a predictable income so that I can pay predictable expenses and do that at the business level versus the personal level? You know, it definitely solved that problem for us. And, you know, I hope I'm not speaking out of school. I don't think I am, but Jimmy and Tom in particular were both guys that were like, look, man, if you give me a dollar, I'm going to spend a dollar. But if you can give me a salary, right, like I can consistently live. It's easier for me to budget when I know what's coming in, versus going from, you know, rice and beans to steak and potatoes. Right. And that was something that was a big driver for Tom coming in. He was, a child of two real estate agents, one in new home construction and sales and one in traditional resale. And that was kind of the story of his upbringing was, you know, hey, we went from one end of the spectrum to the other. And that was part of, we took that approach to it. The second was, you know, he tells stories of, I see real estate agents that, you know, were in my dad's office that, you know, at the end of the day, they're 74 years old and they're driving Cadillacs on bald tires. And, you know, I'm really curious to dive into what you guys have talked about with some of the retirement planning, because for a lot of real estate agents, that's just not on their mind, right? The next transaction is more important than looking 5 or 10 or 15 years out. And so for us, this was a little bit of a way to solve that and bring a traditional small business approach financially with salaries and benefits and retirement accounts into, a very entrepreneurial real estate environment. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, it worked for us as owners. We realized it wasn't a solution for agents that were on our team. So, you know, after stumping our toes a couple of times, stubbing our toes a couple of times, you know, we came back to a traditional commission split model with agents.
I love hearing, you know, all these different successful real estate professionals all have different transitions into the business. And you, the way that you got into it was, you know, you had created through your W-2 income, a salary as that base. And then you were doing real estate to supplement that, you know, to make up for that. It was a 60%, reduction in salary from the career that you had left previously. Interested to know, do you think your experience in creating that for yourself as you entered the business, was that potentially, you know, part of, were you trying to create that for agents on your team? Do you think your experience impacted like some of that structure that you built, or was it, you know, a totally different angle that you guys were coming from as you developed that?
Yeah, no, Jordan, that's a great question. I mean, there was definitely this idea of building stability, right? So my background was in, computer development, database management, project management, right? I came from a very left-brained approach, which is a little atraditional for real estate. I also had a sales upbringing, right? I sold yellow page ads like when phone books still existed, throughout most of my, adolescence and post-adolescence, right? High school and college. So I had seen both sides of predictability and unpredictability. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we were very much able to solve that predictable income piece, like I said, for the ownership, and then use that to build a business that afforded our salaried employees, not our salaried agents, well, our salaried agents to some extent, but our salaried employees for sure, to also have benefits in retirement and the things that come with the traditional W-2 approach. The other thing that we really wanted to do was drive towards the ability to take a business that was scalable and sellable. You know, I don't know that we're there yet. And I think that very, very few, a very small portion of agents actually get to that. And it seems to me that that's a really recent thing that's happened, that agents have been able to go and sell their business. And so what we wanted to do was create something that wasn't built on an individual identity. Like, that's why none of our names are in the name of our company. And so much of real estate agents' success is about the personal relationship, and the personal relationship eventually overcomes the value of the brand, right? Like, if your architect or your accountant or your dentist sells their business, you're still going to call them and show up to have your teeth cleaned or to have your taxes done, you know, or to have your addition designed. But with a real estate agent, when they close their doors, most of the time, the people that they're in relationships with go find a new real estate agent. And so that was a really big benefit that we wanted to bring to our team, and a really big hurdle that we're still trying to get over is, if you can create connection to the brand, both from the client side and the agent side, then you have these relationships that are bigger than just one person. And so for us, that's still a very big goal. And I think that the financial investment it takes to get that requires a lot more, right? Because it's not just Popeyes and phone calls and things like that. And honestly, that's been one of our biggest failings as we've gone through, you know, our journey over the last 10 years. We've had an incredible 10 years, but we've just recently gone through a cycle over the last three where, because we made this shift to support a traditional real estate model, and build, you know, agent connectivity with their clients to teach them the skills to generate their own leads, we lost focus on the ability to generate leads and set appointments for those agents. And so it created this big vulnerability within our team. You know, an agent would wake up in a market like 2019 or 2020 and go, look, I can sell a house without batting an eye. And, you know, I don't understand the value that I'm getting here anymore. Or I question that. Like, I'm going to go try this on my own. And so the moat that we had built, you know, there were gaps in it. There were bridges across it that we've since come back and are trying to address now, right? Like, culture of a team is really important. Connectivity is really important. Service is really important for supporting the things that an agent generally isn't great at on their own, from, you know, marketing to HR to contract to close to listing management to all of the things that an individual agent does. But if that value is not reinforced, it's really easy to look up and go, oh, that's a way bigger check over here than I'm getting where I currently am, and not understanding the difference between gross income, value provided, and then the net income.
Yeah. I think it's a really, you know, I'm not going to name names, but I think we would all understand who this brokerage is. But when you've experienced explosive growth over the last 5 years, and a lot of that growth has been based on cash bonuses to agents, and then sort of like a residual amounts that are coming through, folks forget that at the end of the day, like, when those cash bonuses dry up, they're still kind of stuck on a traditional brokerage split, and there may not be any extra value there. And so I've witnessed a lot of my current clients moving from this unnamed brokerage who has been paying out a lot of cash bonuses all over the country to places where the cost is just significantly lower, right? Mm-hmm. And so they like you guys, and this is not what you guys are doing, but they thought like their value prop was, hey, throw money at you and then you'll never leave because the brand is just so good. It's just so amazing. You know, you just want to be associated with us. Well, actually, the end of the day, you know, it's when those cash bonuses dry up and things get a little bit harder, and you're not providing me any leads, and I don't feel like there's a real culture here, you know, I'm gonna go try something else, go try something new. So, but that was, thank you for bringing a student into that, because that was very vulnerable of you to tell us that. And I think that's where folks learn the most, is from I'm hearing other people say, yeah, this was our failing. This was our mistake. And here's what we learned from it. You know, here's
absolutely.
We got over it. So I think that the other thing that I wanted to ask you about was, did you see, like, with how you built the team culture, did you see that as kind of like that was the ideal version of a real estate team? And then kind of like reality just came through like a train and was just like, nah, that's not going to be it. Because I do have this conversation with folks, you know, they're like, well, this is how it should be, right? They'll say like, well, this is how real estate should be, or this is how real estate should be done, or this is how clients should interact with me, or this is why agents should join my team. And many times the idealism of it just gets, you know, railroaded by reality. So have you, I guess, first of all, was it an idealistic move? And has your idealism been tamped down at all?
I don't think the idealism has changed. Yeah, sure. It was an idealistic approach, and it isn't necessarily a model that doesn't work, right? When you look at salaried agent, it only works in specific ways. I think Redfin proves that to a certain point, right? They are a brokerage that did lose a lot of money for a really long time and started turning a profit. You know, it was a long ramp for them, but real estate inherently is a business where you don't need to do that, right? You should be really profitable out of the gate. And that said, I mean, for us, yeah, we definitely changed our approaches. I look at it with this kind of lens of, look, there are basic things that you need to do. And let's compare it to, you know, football or basketball, right? But say football. So, you know, you've got to score points and you've got to stop the other team from scoring points. Well, the way that you score points, you can do that with the West Coast offense. You can do it with a run and gun. You can do it with spread. You can do it with a traditional I formation. Doesn't matter what your formation is, as long as the plays in your playbook actually work, right? You can stop people from scoring with a 3-4 defense or a 4-3, or sometimes you play a nickel package. So the strategies that are there will vary from team to team. It's about collecting the right players, putting them in the right position, and then executing on your plays, but making sure that your plays come back to the fundamentals of the game or the business. You know, for real estate, I come from a Keller Williams background. Like, it's really clear. The foundation is leads for listings and leads for leverage, right? And that's it. Those are the only things you worry about. And then beyond that, it's the fundamentals of the monetary process, right? So the MREA has a very specific financial model that works for an individual agent, a small team, a large team. And yeah, the numbers are a little bit different, right? The percentages that you spend on cost of sale or on occupancy or on technology change at different levels, or they change based on whether you have a listing agent that's on salary or a listing agent that's on a split. But if the fundamentals are solid and if the right players are in the right seats on the bus, it's all going to flow through and you're going to show up with a net profit on the bottom that reflects, you know, the quality of your input and execution.
What you're saying is follow the models, you know, keep it very simple in that way. Does creativity have a role to play in building a business? And if it does, like, where would it come in?
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, I think creativity is really important for discovering what your value proposition is, right? Discovering how you communicate your value proposition. It's really important in marketing. It's really important in, you know, understanding how your negotiation plays out. It's just not terribly important when it comes to the actual math, right? Like, math is not a creative exercise. And, yeah. You know, it's been said to me many times, Gene Rivers in particular says, you know, that the purpose of a business is to reward the shareholders, you know, and I've heard a lot of people say that numbers are the language of business. Those numbers, there's no creative place in math, right? Like, fuzzy math ends, you know, gives you results you don't want most of the time. The creativity is more in, you know, the outward facing execution, client attraction, agent attraction, team building, things like that. Yeah. And now you could say that there's, you know, as long as you've got the structure down, right? And you want to, let's say you want to be creative, you know, I know we overspend on occupancy, right? Like, that's a line item in our budget that doesn't match up with the traditional budget. But the reason we do that is because we're not renting, you know, we're buying a building. I'm using my real estate team to buy a commercial asset that I individually own with other people. That's a purposeful, you know, creative deviation on our income statement. But I know that it's there. I know why it's there. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll add that it's a really nice office.
Thanks. Hopefully it ends up being a really nice investment. That's, you know, yes, it's nice to have the space. It's important when it plays out the way you intend it to.
I've heard you talk a lot, Ty, about just your team, the culture, just an overall desire to see them succeed. And, you know, part of our angle on this podcast is finance, right? So just curious, as you've led your team, have you seen areas where agents have really succeeded in their personal finances, whether it be from a real estate investing standpoint or maybe a retirement planning standpoint? Are there areas where you're trying to increase like the financial education for those on your team so that they are doing those things that's going to set them up for success in the future?
Yeah, I think those are places where we're definitely having some success. I think there, you know, now that you asked the question and as I'm thinking about it, there are areas where we could really support our agents and dig in a little bit more. And I think the first comes back to a really simple rule that, you know, I was told when I got my very first commission check, you really need to split that into three pieces. You need to save 20% for a rainy day. You need to save 30% to pay the tax man. And then you've got 50% that you can spend on the rest of your life. Yeah. And that simple math will take you a really long way. You know, so I think that's the first thing. And I think that's a really good education for every agent to have and to hold. The second is really more on what we're doing to both teach our agents how to build wealth and then giving them an opportunity to build wealth. I think that real estate agents are in a really interesting situation where we go on appointments all the time and we walk in with the mindset of, okay, what can I sell this house for? And it's probably the wrong question to ask first. The right question is probably, what can I buy this house for? Mm. And if every real estate agent walked in with the mindset of an investor first and an agent second, they would be setting themselves up, I think, for really good long-term success. Now, that's not to say you're going to buy one in 10 or one in 20 or one in 100 of the houses you walk in, but it's the mindset that makes the difference. And so that's something that we've really started to help instilling in our agents and something I'm still trying to digest even more myself. Because what it does is it allows us to go in and buy a property. And if we're not able to do it individually, which in our area, you know, in greater Washington, D.C., we're not always able to do because of the average and median price points, it does afford us the opportunity to band together and buy as a group. Mm-hmm. And so we've done a number of investment purchases, both short-term flips and long-term buy and holds with a collaborative group of agents on our team, with administrative staff on our team, and then extended to friends and family. And I think that's a wonderful opportunity for us to get our people in and practice on that investment and do it with little to low risk and have a pretty good upside on it. It gives them the ability to come back and us to show them the math on how it works, right? The yep. benefit, the return on investment that's there. And I think just the exposure to that makes people start to think a little bit differently. And we've had some agents that have taken that model and gone out to do it on their own, which is even, you know, more exciting that they're able to independently execute on it.
I love that you're creating those opportunities. I think that's one of the biggest struggles that I've personally seen real estate agents have in their personal finances is, not the ability to generate income. Like they have this great income. But then that question of, what do I do with it? They're not like, a traditional W-2 employee where it's just real easy to shoot an email over to, HR and say, hey, increase my 401k contribution and you never even see it in your bank account. If you want to save and invest as a real estate agent, as a small business owner, you have to deliberately be doing that. And there are, there's accounts you can set up. There's definitely things to be done there. But I think purely being exposed to opportunities to invest and start to generate and build wealth for yourself. The more you're exposed to that, I think there's a much, much higher chance of you participating in those things. And a lot of folks just, they're not exposed to it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I can see, I think just over Michael's left shoulders, that Profit First that's up there.
Profit First.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's a great model, right? So you've got your five accounts that are there, like take a sixth one and set it up and call it investment. right? Mm-hmm. And make money go in there individually until, you know, there's an amount that you can take and make an investment purchase like that. There's very little that's going to build wealth over the long term like real estate is. Real estate is not a get rich quick scheme. It never has been, it never will be. And anybody that's trying to use it that way, you know, generally is either going to fail or is, you know, is going to have some other shortfall that's really going to come back to get them. What real estate is it is a get rich over time guarantee, right? At a historical 4% appreciation year over year over year over year with someone else paying your mortgage, paying down your principal, you can't go wrong with it.
Yeah. I think there's so much power in what you were saying earlier about like the seeing the numbers and learning how to do it in somewhat of like a de-risked environment in a little bit, because you're part of a collective group, right? With seasoned investors and new people. So you might be there, you might be able to provide a little bit of capital, but like really the value that you're getting out of that deal, if it's a flip, is just seeing it done, right? And
yeah,
seeing if there are any shortfalls and, hey, why did we miss our projections of profitability on this? Okay, because here were the issues where we maybe could have done more due diligence, or we had overruns, or whatever. So like I want to be part of your team. How do I get access to one of those deals?
Yeah, I mean, I'll offer you into the next one. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really cool. So the last couple of years, right, have been within real estate. So just getting back to like the real estate market in general, they've been very turbulent, right, to say the least, right? 2020 and 2021, it just felt like you were alluding to it. Deals were falling into people's laps, and it was just, it was very frothy. Now we've moved into a much more difficult market for a lot of agents. You know, there's not a lot of inventory. There are not a lot of deals happening. Q4 of last year, we really started to see a fallout. So what now is like the value proposition of Fulcrum Properties Group as it's bringing agents into the team, right? You're attracting agents to the team in a difficult market. Like, what are you saying? What's that talk track?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, first, I think you put it into perspective, right? So in 2022, from 2021 to 2022, we sold 1 million less houses in this country. We went from the most houses ever sold 2 years running to having 1 million houses just disappear. And so what that does is it leads back into the environment of inventory is scarce. And what happens is when we get interest rates that bump up and inventory that's scarce, you get a little bit of buyer whiplash because now it costs more to buy a house, to own a house, and the tire kickers leave the market. So with fewer transactions, there should be and there will be fewer agents to do those transactions. I mean, you look at the history of the last couple of years, we had 1.6 million real estate agents in the National Association of Realtors through the end of 2022. There were 20,000 real estate agents that joined NAR in December of 2022. There were 33,000 that left NAR in January of 2023. So you're already starting to see agents leave the market, and that's going to continue. So for agents that want to stick in, that really want to do the work to help clients buy and sell houses, our value proposition is you need to be laser focused on contact, on belly to belly, voice to voice, eye to eye communication with your leads, your database. The only way to do that, or the best way to do that, in my belief, is to have someone take all of the other stuff off of your plate, right? Like all the benefits that a team structure should provide. So marketing, lockboxes, business cards, you know, MLS entry, contract to close, listing management, all of those things that an agent can lose a massive amount of time to, they need to be taken off the agent's plate. And then the other thing is you need to surround yourself with people who do this job at an unbelievably high level. It's for two reasons. One, so new agents need to be exposed to that as quickly as possible. And when you're selling 6 or 8 houses on your own every year, you don't get to see that happen very much. But when you're in a group that's selling 200 or 300 or 800 houses a year, there's so much more opportunity to see every aspect of the transaction and to get better at it. And then the second part is those people have built skills that are transferable, right? There is a much greater likelihood of succeeding as part of a team. And, you know, it's, again, I'm come back to stuff that Gary Keller says and Seth Off is, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And you come back to this team approach and it's a way to go far. People care for each other. They reach out for each other. They support each other. And I think that environment is just going to be a really crucial piece. It's like any other habit you're trying to build, right? If you're going to get up and go to the gym every day, how hard is it to do that sometimes when you swing your feet out of bed and you're like, oh, I got to go. But if you already have somebody that you know is going to meet you there, or if you've paid a personal trainer in advance, it's really hard to cancel that session. And so I think that accountability and collective achievement is a really big way that agents can plug in and succeed as the market changes. Now, the good news on all of that, like statistical stuff I started with, is even though we're going to probably only sell 4.2 million houses this year, it's going to be the third highest volume year in recorded history. So if you look at it, yeah, it's fewer sales, but you're going to have fewer agents in the market and you're going to have almost just as much money moving through. Yeah. That's a wonderful opportunity for those people that can grind it out to take a larger piece of that economic pie and put it back to work for themselves.
That's great. So, I mean, highest and best use of time was what I took from the beginning of that. You want to make sure, you know, as the economic environment changes, you know, only be doing the things that only you can be doing, you know, those things that can be delegated. And quite honestly, someone who does that on a regular basis might even be able to do it better than what you can. Delegate those things, focus on, you know, your sphere, generating those leads, everything that you need to do in your sales position.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think you're actually, what you're pitching is a lesson on opportunity cost. And I think that's really helpful for folks to learn, because, you know, many people who get into real estate, they're just, the only thing they're thinking about, right, is the first sale or the second sale, you know, getting a few transactions under their belt. So then if you can shift their mindset to, okay, you've got a few transactions under your belt, you've been in this for a couple of years. Now let's help you specialize. Like, let's help you actually get to the point where you're just not a generalist kind of, you know, all over the place. We'll help you be like a killer in just a few specific ways, and that will supercharge your revenue. And then you have opportunities for everything else. On the sort of the theme of opportunity cost, I'm interested in what is the opportunity cost of attracting the wrong type of agent to your team? Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different opportunity costs there. I mean, you know, and the wrong type of agent can come in many different ways, right? So it could come in one that doesn't meet the cultural setup. It could, you know, so if your culture is one of productivity, it could come in an agent who doesn't hit the productivity standards. And I think the direct impact there is that the people who do perform at the level that you've set for the standard, they feel deflated by that. I mean, could you imagine if you take, you know, I know that there was a G League star that won the dunk contest this year in the NBA All-Star game, but could you imagine if you took, you know, like that guy that's a college walk-on and you put him in the starting lineup for the Olympic team, right? Mm-hmm. Like everybody else on that team is going to be deflated by this person playing. It's going to bring down the overall level of performance. So I think that and the opportunity cost is a big one. I think when you get to a different cultural mismatch, if somebody acts unethically or is uncommitted in, you know, their time dedication or doesn't practice their craft in the same way, it can certainly bring down morale, but it can actually drive people away. So it's not just about bringing down performance, but it starts to fray at the fabric of, I think, what holds a team together. And that could be the way that they interact with other agents, certainly be the way that they interact with administrative staff. And if you get that, to me is one that's really one, it's really worth watching, is what your agent interaction is with your client care, administrative, operational staff. Because fundamentally, those people that are your W-2 salaried employees that do drive the business forward on an administrative level, they're the heart of your organization. They're the culture that really binds things together. If you've built your business the right way, and this is a lesson that we're actively learning and restructuring our business, where you're bringing in leads and you're passing out those leads or appointments to agents to close and service, the agent is less important than the staff that drives the business, right? Because if you've got the leads, you can change the players that are on the court, right? If you don't, you're beholden to those agents. And we certainly got ourselves into a position where we were very beholden. And it's not to say that I don't miss the agents that we have or that I devalue the ones that are here now. I value them greatly. But it is to say that, you know, the culture of the organization starts with, you know, your W-2 salaried employees that take care of everyone in your organization and your clients outside of your organization. The way that we look at our business inherently is that, you know, Tom and I work for our agents, that our admin staff works for our agents, that you know, our market center works for us, that Gary Keller works for us. And if you look at it from the servant mentality of rather than being top down, it's bottom up that way. I think that you'll get a little bit more cultural integrity and a realization of where the value is there.
It's awesome. It's great. So I had a question. I want to make kind of a hard shift. We don't want to run over time, and I do want to bring it back to financials. But Ty, I want to know really two things. The first is, now that you run a large business, a large team, first is, what is your cadence for checking in on the financial health of the business? And then the second is, what, when you, after you've sort of seen what the numbers are, what the projections are like, what's your paradigm for then making decisions, right? Should we spend more? Should we spend less? Should we hire? Should we fire? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. So we have, we look at that in three different ways. So the first thing is, on a daily basis, I check in on what our numbers are. And so our CFO puts together a list of all of the cash assets that are available in all the bank accounts. He looks at all of the pending income, both for the next 30-day period or for the existing month. And then we look at the overall total pending. And then that gives us the ability to calculate what we call our runway, right? So knowing what our fixed expenses are every single month, knowing what our average cost of sale is, we can look at, okay, how much cash do we have in the bank and how long will that last us if we don't close another sale? And then we look at how long will it last us, assuming that the things that are on the books actually close. And so runway is the first thing, and I take a look at that on a daily basis. The second thing is our budget to our actuals, right? So looking at our profit and loss or our income statement every single month and doing a comparison of that versus what we did last year and then that versus our budget, right? So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is the decision analysis. So we have really specific cuts that are predefined that we put in place when our runway changes, right? So we look at our runway in 0 to 2 months, 2 to 4 months, and then 4 to 6 months. So those are the areas that we've got things, you know, just like you would have DEFCON 1 through 5. Mm-hmm. I guess we have DEFCON 1 through 3, right? And so the goal is always to be above 4 months. When we get above 6 months, then we know that we can be a little bit more creative, that we can reinvest a little bit harder, that we can lean into profit share and bonuses. And then when we get down below 2 months, if we get down below 2 months, we're looking really, really hard at every dollar that goes out the door and why it's going out the door. And the first question that we ask is, when this goes out the door, is it to pay for a person or is it to provide a return on investment? And those are the two important things that we're looking at. Everything else is just either extra or ego. And those are the places where you need to cut your expenses.
I think that is incredibly sound advice. For an agent at any stage, really, you know, it's very simple at first to look at your pendings, your cash in your bank, right? It's all there. It's all right in front of you. But as you grow the team, you have to develop, you know, like a plan and a cadence and a person. I mean, you mentioned your CFO, right? You have to, you run an organization like yours, you actually have to have somebody whose job it is to focus on this full time, right? And to make sure that those numbers they're looking at are actually correct, right? There is no fuzzy math, that the math is 100% black and white. Or else, you know, there's all sorts of ways that folks will try and justify their spending, right? If it's not distributed over multiple people, right? Or there's a CFO, the CEO, maybe an outsourced person, right? They're all looking at it. There could be a tendency for the CEO of the business to be like, yeah, well, I guess I still need that thing. You know, I think we'll just keep, you know, because you always just want to justify rather than get rid of stuff or, you know, get rid of contractors and things like that. So yeah. Jordan, did you have any last questions for Ty?
Yeah. So we have a reoccurring question that we always ask to end each podcast. And that question is, what's possible now? So what does the future look like for Fulcrum? What are the possibilities that get you excited?
Yeah, I love that. So right now, I mean, we're really focused on per agent productivity. That for us is the North Star. You know, I think that most agents had incredible production periods over the last couple of years. We had incredibly challenging periods over the last couple of years. And a lot of that for us comes back to just a lack of focus or a waning focus that we allowed on actions and accountability. And because of that, we saw our per agent productivity decrease. So our first goal is really just to get that back up, to rebuild that productivity piece within our culture, and then grow from there. And I think when we do that, it allows us not to just say, okay, you know, we want to pursue this single opportunity, but we can look up and say, great, what are the opportunities that our people want individually? And then how can we use those and fulfill them so that they can grow further? But more than anything else, and you know, it's just how do we make sure we never take our focus on those productivity numbers?
I love it. That's great.
Well, Ty, thank you so much for your time. You were super generous and bringing us along into your story. And maybe a couple of years from now, I'll have you back. We'll get an update.
That sounds great, man. I'd love to come back. And I appreciate you guys for inviting and for being flexible with timing and stuff, and which is great.
Thanks, Ty.
Great. All right. See you, Ty.
Cheers.
Information is for illustrative purposes only and does not constitute tax, investment, or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified investment, legal, or tax professional before taking any action.